The time is now. Well, it's a little bit corny, that song, but you gotta admit, it is kind of catchy. Thanks for listening in any event, everybody. I really appreciate you coming back to us, and for those who are finding us for the first time, thanks so much for joining. This is Volume 1, Episode 16 of Employment Law Now, and I am Mike Schmidt, Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Cozen O'Connor. So much is going on in employment law. It's really amazing, and to some people, it's a little overwhelming to keep up and keep abreast of what's going on. You got things going on in the judicial branch with the United States Supreme Court and all kinds of other courts across this great country. You got the legislative branch and Congress on the federal level and state and local legislatures doing their thing. And you also have the executive branch chiming in with President Trump, obviously, on the federal level, but also executive branch members across the country on the state and local levels, too. So let's try to keep up with what's going on and give you a little bit of updates on some noteworthy trends and some noteworthy cases. Let's start with Trending Now, our Trending Now segment. We have talked in the past about how employees are becoming so much more politically active, both in the workplace and outside the workplace. Today's climate really is evidencing a lot of political activism by employees, and things have ratcheted up recently, it seems, with the National Football League. For those of you who are not aware, last year in 2016, then quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, Colin Kaepernick, decided to kneel during the national anthem to protest what he viewed as social injustices. A lot of players have taken to that and have decided to join the cause both last year and more pronounced, I would say, this year. And a couple of weeks ago, President Trump really fueled the flames a little bit by calling out the NFL players and saying that NFL teams should fire anybody who decides to kneel for the national anthem. And there really has been a national debate as to whether this is something good that the players are doing, or whether it is something that is not a good thing because the national anthem and the American flag are something that should really be viewed as a positive, and people should be looking at that not in a negative way. So the question, though, is can the NFL legally discipline or ultimately fire a player for this political protest, this kneeling for the national anthem, if any owner out there doesn't like it? I'm not taking sides here, and it really is not such an easy question, but you've got to look at some factors here. First, and I hear this all the time, people talk about the First Amendment and don't they have a right to free speech. There really is no First Amendment issue here at all. The NFL is not a state actor, and private employers, like the NFL teams, are not within the ambit of the First Amendment. So that doesn't really come into play. But as I've said before, you do have to look at those jurisdictions that have, for example, legal activity laws that allow employees to engage in political activities, lawful political activities, and preclude employers from retaliating against them, disciplining them, firing them, because they're engaging in those legal political activities. The question, however, and what you have to look for, is whether those statutes allow for political activities to be engaged in on premises, in the company's workplace, and in the case of the NFL, that's arguably the playing field, and whether they protect against political activities that take place during work time and in the case of the NFL, that is during the game. So are the NFL players who are engaging in this arguable political activity by kneeling for the national anthem, are they doing it during work time, i.e. during the game? Are they doing it on company premises, i.e. the playing field? That's going to be a question that you really have to look to see what the statute says in your particular jurisdiction. And also be careful, because some states, some local municipalities have very broad anti-retaliation provisions that protect against discipline, termination, and other forms of alleged retaliation if you do something that goes against public policy. So if there's a public policy in your jurisdiction that allows employees to engage in activity X, well, your particular statute may have an anti-retaliation provision that protects that activity and precludes you as a company from taking adverse action against it. So as I've said many times before, when we're talking about these kinds of things, it's very easy to have the emotion of the particular situation dictate what you as an employer may decide to do, but you want to be careful. And I'm not saying in all cases you can never take adverse action, and I'm certainly not saying in all cases that you can, but step back from the emotion of it, step back from just immediately thinking to yourself, this isn't something I like, this isn't something I want, and make sure you have done the proper analysis, make sure you've looked at your jurisdiction's law to see if you are on solid ground in taking adverse action, if that's what you want to do. Our next segment is the Noteworthy Now segment. Noteworthy Now. And the question here is, how much leave does a company have to give for an individual with a medical condition? This question seems to pop up all the time. HR, benefits folks, even in-house counsel grapple with this notion of how much leave is reasonable. What do we have to do to accommodate an individual with a medical condition? And no surprise here, the answer is not an easy one, and it's not a bright line one. It really depends on the particular situation. Keep in mind, as I am sure that you do, that there are a lot of different statutes working here. You've got the FMLA that requires a certain amount of leave if the situation is covered by that statute. You have the Americans with Disabilities Act on the federal side, which requires some interactive process and some form of accommodation for the covered disability if the situation is in fact covered. You also have other kinds of statutory schemes, workers' comp, for example, and other state and local laws that provide for certain kinds of leaves of absences and certain kinds of accommodations when the situation is covered. But what happens when somebody takes FMLA leave, they've taken their 12 weeks and the 12 weeks are up, and they still have a condition that requires perhaps additional leave? What happens? Well, unlike the FMLA, when you're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, there is no set amount of leave that is required. In other words, the FMLA is a leave statute. The ADA is not a leave statute. It is a discrimination statute. The ADA says you cannot discriminate against somebody because of their disability. It also requires, as I've said, some form of accommodation under certain circumstances. And leave and a leave of absence is not the only possible accommodation. If there is an alternate effective accommodation that works in the situation, then leave is not something that has to be given. So what is reasonable when we are talking about giving an employee a leave of absence because of a medical condition? Well, there have been many courts which say that indefinite leaves and extended indefinite leaves in particular are not necessarily reasonable. So you have many jurisdictions which say if you have an individual who has been out on a good number of months out on an extended leave, simply having the employee tell the company, well, I still need more time, but I can't tell you exactly how much time and I can't tell you exactly when I'm going to come back, many courts have said that that is not a reasonable accommodation, and therefore the company does not have to grant an indefinite leave. But a very interesting case, particularly for employers, just came down in the Seventh Circuit. And the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals covers Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. For those of you keeping score at home, the name of the case is Severson versus Heartland Woodcraft, and it addresses this particular issue. aside from it being an indefinite leave question, what happens if simply the employee has used up his FMLA leave but just needs a little bit more time and that time is defined? Well, the court here, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, held that even a multi-month leave of absence may be unreasonable when the FMLA time has been used up. In this particular case, you had an individual who was fighting a back injury, went out and had his 12 weeks of FMLA leave, and on the last day of that leave, had back surgery. After the surgery, told the company, I need 2 to 3 more months of leave. So it wasn't indefinite. I need 2 to 3 months of leave. The court, the Seventh Circuit, said that an employee who requires multiple months of leave is not somebody who is qualified under the ADA because an employee who needs long-term medical leave can't work. And so the court said, quote, a multi-month leave of absence is beyond the scope of a reasonable accommodation under the ADA, end quote. Now, what's not clear is whether this ruling is somewhat limited by the facts, and what I mean by that is here you had somebody who already took an FMLA leave. Now, other courts that have dealt with this issue have suggested certainly that the ADA stands alone, and there is no 12-week limit to a possible leave as a reasonable accommodation under the statute. And so as long as this is not just an indefinite extended leave, you need to go through this interactive process, and there may be a requirement to give an employee leave. But here the Seventh Circuit in the Severson case said, no, the individual had his 12 weeks of leave. Asking for another 2 to 3 months of leave on top of that is simply not reasonable. So this is certainly a very positive decision for employers, certainly for those of you who are in the Seventh Circuit states, but we need to see where this goes from here. We'll see if other federal courts decide to follow the reasoning and certainly the holding in this case, and we'll see how what kind of legs this decision has. But for the moment, a very significant decision for employers. We move now to our DC Update Now segment. The DC Update Now segment, and a couple of issues that I want to update you on that are going on in Washington, and you've certainly been reading and hearing a lot about them. First, the overtime rule. As you know, President Obama's Department of Labor had proposed the new overtime rule last year. The district court decided to grant an injunction just before Thanksgiving to put that all on hold. And then just recently, the district court invalidated that Department of Labor rule in its entirety. So where are we going from here? Well, as you have also undoubtedly read and heard, and as we talked about in a prior episode, the new Trump Department of Labor issued a request for information that posed 11 questions, each of them with various sub-questions, out to the general public, asking for comments on specific issues, asking for comments from employers, from employees, about what do they view as the salary threshold that should be adopted here? What do they believe should be done with the job duties test? There's a whole host of questions. The comment period did close last month. Approximately 165,000 comments were submitted, a lot of them, obviously. And now it's up to the Department of Labor to go through those comments and decide what it's going to do. Many of us believe the Department of Labor is going to propose a new rule. I think if you really forced me to make some sort of prognostication, I would say that the Department of Labor is going to raise the salary threshold a bit, certainly not up to the $47,000 and change that the Obama Department of Labor was proposing. But I think this Department of Labor does recognize in a bipartisan way that the current level in the 20,000s is certainly too low in 2017. So maybe we're going to cut the baby in half and propose something in the mid 30,000 range as a salary threshold. The more interesting question is going to be whether the Department of Labor decides to propose something new with the job duties tests, make some shorter tests, change up the tests a little bit. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. Keep listening, and I'll update you further when something new happens. The next thing that I want to update you on is the class waiver issue. Again, we've talked about that a lot in prior episodes too, where there has been the case brought to the Supreme Court, three cases in fact, raising the issue of whether employers are permitted to force employees to sign arbitration agreements that contain class action waivers, where the employees waive their right to participate as a member of a class. In other words, instead, they've got to pursue arbitration if they've got any claims, and they've got to do it on an individual basis. Well, last Monday, on October 2nd, the Supreme Court heard oral argument over that issue. The Supreme Court appears to be mixed, likely really on party lines. But again, if you were forcing my hand and asked me to give you some prognostication, I would say that the more likely outcome is going to be a 5-4 decision in favor of class action waivers, which really I think is going to change the game dramatically. I think employers are now going to really think long and hard about whether litigation poses enough of an advantage to them to not want to have their employees sign employment agreements that have arbitration provisions and class action waivers within those provisions. It's really going to affect dramatically class action litigation in the employment field and certainly in the wage and hour area. So we will see what the Supreme Court does when it issues a decision, and keep it right here. We will bring you that decision as soon as it comes down. As long as we're talking about the Supreme Court, they just did start their new term this month, and in addition to the class action waiver issue, there are a few other cases that I think are worth watching from the employer standpoint. One is sexual orientation protected class under Title VII. Now, I think here there may be less dramatic of an impact, depending on which way the court goes here. Obviously, it's a very important social issue, but in some respects, it's a very academic issue because you have many states and local municipalities that have already included sexual orientation as a protected class under their own anti-discrimination statutes. So even if Title VII is found not to bar discrimination based on sexual orientation, you still have in many jurisdictions state and local statutes that do. Another case before the Supreme Court, the Fourth Circuit's joint employer test involving DirecTV. Is it too expansive a test under the FLSA? Should we be narrowing the test to determine whether entities can be considered joint employers? The Fourth Circuit's new joint employer test is at issue in another case before the U.S. Supreme Court that we're watching. So is a tip credit rule. And the question is a Department of Labor rule that deems tips to be the property of the employee, whether or not the employer uses the tip credit, is that rule worthy of deference? There is this rule out there that says courts should give deference to government agencies that are tasked with interpreting and enforcing certain rules. But in the recent years, courts have seemingly gone a little bit away from that rule of deference, particularly when they think that an agency like the Department of Labor has been overreaching and has really become too activist to be able to simply and blindly defer to them. So that's going to be an interesting question before the Supreme Court this term. And lastly, there's also a question about meal breaks that I think is going to be interesting and worthy of following. Can a paid meal break be used to offset overtime obligations for pre- and post-shift work time? So we will continue to watch for decision on that case, as well as all of these others that have been and are being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. So much going on, so much going on. Isn't that really what makes employment law so fun these days? So we move on to our Noteworthy Now segment, our Noteworthy Now segment. And, you know, Restrictive covenants continues to be a real hot topic because there seems to be this trend going across the country that's disfavoring restrictive covenants. You're seeing it on the state and local level more than the federal level. But the notion is restrictive covenants are just being used way too much, and they're being used way too much for particular positions that serve only to chill employees from being able to move and earn a living, and they're not really doing anything to protect legitimate business interests of those employers who are forcing the employee to enter into those restrictive covenants. So that's been the argument, and there's been a trend toward addressing that issue really statutorily by creating laws that restrict restrictive covenants only to certain kinds of situations. But when we talk about restrictive covenants, the discussion tends to be centered about how the restrictive covenant may or may not be appropriate for the particular provision, for the particular position, or how reasonable are the geographic and the time restrictions. Very few people think about the issue of what consideration can or must be given for a restrictive covenant to be enforceable. And an interesting decision from the North Carolina Business Court really chimed in with a nice decision on this consideration issue. The case, if you're keeping score at home, is American Air Filter Company versus Samuel Price and Camfil USA. Here you had a one-year employment contract that was entered into 17 years after the employee's employment started. A one-year employment agreement, which was automatically renewed for subsequent one-year periods. The employment contract had a one-year covenant not to compete, and the employee was given additional compensation in addition to his salary in exchange for signing it when he first signed the original employment agreement. Well, the contract auto-renewed several times, years passed, and then after a few years, the employee decided to resign and go to a competitor. Well, his employer sued to try to enforce the non-compete. The employee filed a motion to dismiss, saying that it should not be enforceable. And the North Carolina Business Court granted the employee's motion to dismiss, saying that even at that initial stage, the restrictive covenant could not be enforced. The reason was that the employer here failed to allege that it gave additional consideration every time the contract automatically renewed. In other words, there was sufficient consideration the first time the employee signed it, and then presumably if the employee had left within that first year, it would have been an enforceable restrictive covenant, at least as far as the consideration argument goes. But after that first year, every time it automatically renewed, it became a new contract. And in that state, there had to be additional consideration given each time it renewed for its provisions to be enforceable. It was a North Carolina business court decision. Wasn't applying North Carolina law. They happened to be applying Kentucky law. So that certainly is at play here. And, you know, it's not to say that this decision has any real weight in other states, but it's a noteworthy decision on this consideration issue because, as I said, many decisions rely on and address restrictive covenant issues of all kinds other than this consideration issue. But it's worth keeping this in mind because wherever you are as a company, if you are looking to draft and enforce your restrictive covenant agreements, you need to look at your state's, your jurisdiction's law on the issue, not just on the issue of how can I tailor the temporal and the geographic provisions so that they're enforceable, but what kind of consideration do I have to give? There are some states out there which say continued employment of an at-will employee is sufficient consideration. But there are other jurisdictions like this one which say, no, you have to give actual additional consideration in order to enforce your restrictive covenant. So that's certainly a noteworthy case, as is the next one, the next noteworthy now case. It seems like we are adding something to the list of protected classes every day. Is being beautiful, is being pretty the next protected class? Well, the case is Edwards versus Nicolai, right here in my backyard in New York State Court, in fact. The facts are fairly simple. Here, the boss's wife got jealous of the female plaintiff, thinking that the female plaintiff and the boss were having some sort of relationship in the office. And the boss's wife caused this female plaintiff to be fired. Well, there was a lawsuit. The plaintiff, the fired employee, sued. And the first court, the trial court in New York State, said that attractiveness is not a protected class and dismissed the gender discrimination claims that were brought here. Well, of course, that decision was appealed, and in New York State, you appeal the Supreme Court decision up to the Appellate Division. Here is the Appellate Division First Department in New York City. There was oral argument before that appellate court back in May, and just recently, the Appellate Division reversed that dismissal. Sort of fact-specific here, and the procedural posture where this case is procedurally makes a difference because, again, it was at a motion-to-dismiss stage. There was no discovery, so the court was required to accept all of the allegations in the complaint as true. But here, the First Department made a couple of very interesting statements. The First Department says, "It is well established that adverse employment actions motivated by sexual attraction are gender-based and therefore constitute unlawful gender discrimination." Here, there was no claim of sexual harassment, but it was enough to allege, as the fired plaintiff did, that the discharge, the firing, was motivated by a desire to appease the boss's wife's jealousy. And that motivation, the appellate court said, is sexual in nature. In other words, the individual was fired for no reason other than the belief that one was sexually attracted to her. So it seems, and we'll see where that case goes at this point. Does it get settled? Does it go through discovery? Will we have other decisions? I don't know. But for the moment, it certainly does seem that being beautiful may be a protected class here. Well, that is certainly an action-packed half hour of employment law discussion. What do you all think about that? Keep the comments coming, please. Keep the feedback coming. It really has been terrific hearing from all of you. I've gotten great emails, people talking about topics that they've heard, questions that they've had about those topics, topics that they would love to hear, guests that they would love to hear from on future episodes. And I do have a couple of great guests coming up in our next two episodes. And I'm going to just leave it at that. And you'll have to subscribe if you haven't, or listen if you already have. And I think you'll be pleased. I do hate to tease so far in advance, but the end of our 2017 year is, I think, going to be a fun one as well. The end of the year wrap-up, it's going to be something special. I'm not going to tell you exactly what we're doing, but I think you're going to like it. I think you're going to enjoy it. You won't want to miss it. Until then, I really thank you again for listening, and I hope all of your labor is productive.